Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 747.EX0722, certificate number 37883, The Magic Gang.
Because making something disappear isn't enough. You have to bring it back. That's why every magic trick has a third act.
Stage magic has come up in Omnibus before, because
we love it.
We like to be fooled. We like to be baffled.
We like
by
it
skill.
Anytime someone uses the word voila.
Wait, do you feel like that's the magician's word is voila?
Voila.
They don't say presto to you, they say voila.
Are you
thinking of chefs?
Do they say presto to you? They say voila to me.
No, you're thinking of a chef.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Well, is it a rabbit or like a fricasseed rabbit that he pulls out?
I see. I see what you're saying. I see where I might have gotten confused.
What is being revealed with voila? Because if it's a rotisserie chicken, voila. That's not a magician probably.
But it might be a rabbit in a hat. I just didn't think whether it was cooked or not. My great uncle used to say abracadabra so much that when I was a toddler, my nickname for him was Abradabra.
He said it so much. What social situations can you say the word abracadabra in?
I mean, I guess if you're talking to a toddler and it's 1970.
So he just said it for fun, or was he like he found his car keys?
Oh, he did. He did coin behind the ear magic.
I see.
But he would say abracadabra about things. I mean, he's a World War I veteran, so.
I like the idea that he would use it as kind of an exclamation. Like if he stubs his toe, abracadabra.
Oh, I guess he didn't do that, but that's pretty good. Abracadabra.
Or as a racial slur, I don't know.
I might start saying it to my preteen daughter, abracadabra.
That could just be your family safe word.
Yeah.
That's how you know that dad is here to pick you up from school.
Yeah, for the stranger danger.
Sometimes we have a little fun at the expense of stage magicians,
yes,
I think.
They are nerds.
On Omnibus.
I had a friend come over the other day who, halfway through his visit, revealed that he'd been studying stage magic.
And then disappeared.
Into his hat. No, I actually called my daughter and said, get over here right now. And
abracadabra.
Abracadabra,
get over here.
And then I made this friend of mine. I was like, I'm not interested in talking to you anymore. I insist that you do a bunch of close-up magic for my kid.
And dance, monkey.
It was pretty good.
Had he come loaded up? Did he have hankies up his sleeves?
Well, yeah, he had a bag full of different things. And he did.
Imagine how long it takes to leave the house when you're a stage magician.
But it's all
like a dove in my hat.
It's all little stuff, little cards and little. But he did one in particular card trick involving three of us that was, at the end, we were all like, okay, that was really good. And I'm still thinking about it, and I still don't know how he did
it. I think a fun genre would be podcast descriptions of magic tricks.
Yeah.
Because people would be like, no way. And then I turned it over, and it was the Eight of Spades. No. How did you describe how he did that?
What we should do is start trying to describe Far Side comics, one of my favorite things. So there are some cows, okay?
There's some cavemen.
They're standing up like people, okay? But they're in a field. And then the other thing, one of the things that inhibits me from doing my brutalism episode that I've been working on for 8 years is that a lot of it would just require that I describe brutalist architecture, which is like dancing about architecture.
It's a big, blocky.
So it's made of concrete, and it's weird.
Well, here's a funny behind-the-scenes story about Omnibus that maybe you don't want me to tell. Is when we did the live show recently, you asked me, hey, should we show slides? And I was like, yeah, I guess we could.
And you were like, 'cause I think it'd be great. It would really add something. And I said, but you realize nobody would see them who was listening. And you were like, oh yeah.
Oh yeah. We're going to actually broadcast the show. The people in the audience would have been interested by it.
The people listening would have been mystified by the laughter.
Yeah, right. They still will be mystified by the laughter.
So even though we've had some fun at the expense of stage magicians, John, what if I made you choose teams? Stage magicians over here on one hand, or on the other hand, Adolf Hitler.
You're really holding up your hands on...
And the Third Reich.
But Hitler is over in the curtains.
It turned out I didn't have as much extension on my left-hand side here.
So I can't even see Hitler over there.
Well, I don't
so.
Want to push him into... Like, he shouldn't have all this Lebensraum over here. I don't want Hitler to be able to get all the way over here to the side.
There's no Lebensraum there. He can't even get out of the curtain.
I'm trying to contain him in the curtain.
Yeah, good, good, good.
But, you know, that was Neville Chamberlain's idea.
And you know
that... didn't work.
You notice... That's true. I was explaining that to my daughter the other day. I said... She was like, when did World War II start? And I said, well, let's talk.
If you're not American, September 1st, 1939.
Well, except, yeah, that's right. I mean, if you're Austrian, boy, that's a tricky question.
If you're Austrian, you weren't sure which side you were rooting for until very late.
Well, but some Austrians are still fighting the Civil War. That curtain has a bunch of sailing ships on it, you'll notice, because it is mid-century modern. And so you're
is
not...
That's the definition of mid-century modern? Has a bunch of sailing ships on it?
Sailing ships on it, yeah. But so Hitler was actually contained by the British Navy.
I didn't know my childhood jammies were so mid-century modern.
They were, though, because I think mid-century goes up to 1979.
Okay, that's good to know.
From 1929 to 1979, typically, you know, it is in the mid.
But does it go to 1987 when I saw my first R-rated movie? We were just discussing
your
this.
Your first R-rated movie... The Untouchables.
Brian De Palma's The Untouchables.
Starring Sean Connery and Kevin Costner.
Correct.
I do not believe that is mid-century. I believe that is late 20th century.
Well, plus it's you know, 1930s gangster nostalgia, so.
How old were you?
Middle school.
Because I want to show The Untouchables to my middle school daughter, but her mother says it's R-rated and she's not allowed to see R-rated movies.
What? I'm trying to get my head around this. You want to show just this random De Palma movie that nobody has thought about for decades to your daughter?
It's a great film.
I don't mind it. I think it's good.
No, it's nice. There's only a couple scenes that are especially violent, and she's watched all the Star Wars movies where people get cut in half with lightsabers.
Yeah, but she's never seen anyone bring a knife to a gunfight, or the other way around.
Yeah, it was a knife to a gunfight.
If he sends one of your men to the... hospital, you send one of his men to the morgue.
Yeah, well, that's how Sean Connery bites it in the end.
Spoilers!
Oh, sorry! Ooh.
The real ending is he wins an Oscar. So this is a story about the eternal struggle between, on the one hand, stage magic, and on the other hand,
Hitler.
Third Reich. Of
wait, you've just switched hands. Now you're making the stage magic hand the one in the
curtains. Did I switch hands, John? Or was it an illusion?
Are we punch drunk? It's the middle of the day.
In 1949, Jasper Maskelyne published a book called
Come on.
Magic
Come
Top
on.
Secret.
Come on, I'll stop you right there. Jasper Maskelyne.
So Jasper Maskelyne, not masculine, Jasper Maskelyne.
Oh, Maskelyne.
And it's spelled even cooler, Maskelyne.
Ooh, that is cool. Maskelyne.
And he's part of the Maskelyne dynasty, this grand old family of British stage magicians.
Maskelyne.
His grandfather was no less than John Neville Maskelyne, who basically invented levitation as a stage art. As you know,
is it a nom de stage, a nom de stage, or are they Dutch, or where?
No, yeah, where it could. It must
gotta
be
a Dutch.
It must be
name.
Norman, maybe. What do you think? It's French.
Maskelyne.
Maskelyne.
I mean that
the Y is weird,
is
right?
Throwing me off.
What is up with the Y? His grandfather also invented the Victorian pay toilet, or at least had the idea that you could put a penny slot in a door lock and therefore both make the restrooms more exclusive and more secure.
I mean, by that standard, he also invented the peep show.
That's if you take the penny out of the... He invented the glory hole, but you could put a penny in it, I guess is what I'm saying. So Jasper Maskelyne came from a long family. In fact, his sister and brother and... you know, he had aunts and uncles that were magicians. His grandfather, John Neville Maskelyne, actually pretended to be the descendant of former astronomer royal Neville Maskelyne, who was the first ever to compute the mass of the Earth.
Pretended to be.
But it turns out
there are multiple masculine families.
It turns out they are not related. This guy is named John Neville Maskelyne, and he is not related to another famous British person named Neville Maskelyne, which tells you,
come on,
which tells you they just have weirder names than we do by an order of magnitude, I think.
I'm dubious. I'm going to go on ancestry.com and put these two together.
If you elbow your way to the back of a train car on the London Underground, you're passing six people named Neville Maskelyne, and none of them are related, and several of them are West Indian. But Jasper Maskelyne was one of the leading music hall magicians of the early 20th century.
Or magic hall musicians.
Yeah, I guess it's not a music hall if he's there.
That was my Sean Connery impression.
Accidental
music hall musicians.
Occasionally we have some accidental Sean Connery on this show when we just mumble a bit. If you look at him, he looks like what you would want a magician of the era to look like. He's got raven dark hair that comes to a widow's peak, a little mustache that's debonair, but a little menacing the way it turns up on the end, like in a way that no one would do today because you look like a villain of some kind. He's got piercing green eyes, cleft chin. You know, he's not Jasper Feminine. Let's put it that way. Uh-huh. Like he's a matinee idol looking magician who looks like he does have a lot of skills and occult powers not available to the average Briton.
Hair parted rakishly and really slicked down with oil, tuxedo and tails.
Tuxedo and tails all the time, probably sleeps in it.
He looks like Cab Calloway in the Blues Brothers dream sequence.
That's right. This is a guy who can immediately pull a dove from anywhere.
Yeah.
And, but our story really, you know, in his book, Magic Top Secret, kind of begins in 1939 when he says he becomes focused on, quote, how best to mobilize the world of magic against Hitler. A thing that perhaps, most of us do not consider, like how best to mobilize stage magic against the rise of fascism.
Now that you've given me it as a puzzle, I'm bowled over by the number of ways I feel like we could have defeated Hitler with magic.
Oh, you're not thinking that. I thought maybe you would think there's no relation, but you think no, like clearly.
If Chamberlain had gone to Berchtesgaden and done some close-up magic and befuddled Hitler, maybe Hitler would have said, well, you know, I shouldn't precipitate a war with these.
Just silken hattest in a rabbit hat.
Hasenpfeffer.
The Hasenpfeffer is in der Homburg. So thinking about it, Maskelyne writes that he realized there would be his magic background gives him an incredible leg up that no other segment of society has in the war against Hitler. He says, quote, there are no limits to the effects I can produce on the battlefield.
Whoa.
Thanks to, you know, which to me seems like hubris, but let's let him cook. Let's see what happens.
Okay.
He joins the
Royal battlefield. Okay.
You're thinking he would go immediately to espionage. He would try to assassinate Hitler with a razor bladed eight of spades.
Well, no, but I mean Operation Mincemeat, where they dropped a dead hobo into the ocean with secret papers about D-Day. That seems like a kind of
secret fake papers.
That seems like a magic trick. But he's saying like, yeah, so, I'm gonna make the Eiffel Tower disappear or whatever.
Exactly. That's exactly what he's saying.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yes. Oh. He is saying you can't bomb the Eiffel Tower if I have made it disappear. You and I having, especially in your case, more than a healthy amount of knowledge about World War I means we know a lot of these little historical alleys and footnotes where this kind of misdirection did actually come into play and kind of became a head game that did help win the war in Europe. But Maskelyne, of course, predates all this. He's just thinking, with smoke and mirrors, perhaps I can do something that the tank corps cannot. And
you remember in the run-up to D-Day, they invented balloon tanks, and they had southern England all covered with brigades of tanks made out of rubber.
This is the story we're about to tell.
No!
From kind of a sidelight, yes. Because these kind of tactics had never been used before. You know, I think even somebody like you cannot think of World War I or Civil War precursors to this kind of chicanery, right? Like this is a straight up, this is a World War II invention.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Previously, the British were not, they had been innocent in World War I. They were just poets dying in the trenches.
I mean, they were digging.
Now they're a hardened nation, not just of shopkeepers, but of stage magicians.
They were drinking, or they were digging long rabbit tunnels and putting explosives under the barbed wire lines, blowing them up, and then 2 days later losing all that territory again.
And now they're cynical and tricky. Yeah. Now they think, how can we outthink the Hun? You know,
right.
It turned out a protracted trench war was not the way to beat Jerry. We got a second chance, inflatable tank. So there's a lot of lateral thinking going on that kind of lends an espionage angle to World War II that maybe previously.
You know, a great magic trick was when the Germans faced the Maginot Line and just went around it. That was a pretty good magic trick.
They just kind of waved their hands. Hey, friends, look over there.
Oops, we're going through Belgium.
And while they were distracted, they looked at the top card. So Maskelyne volunteers for the Royal Engineers. In particular, he winds up with an outfit called the Camouflage Training and Development Center, located in Farnham, if I'm reading my own handwriting correctly. He eventually rises through the ranks to major. He finishes the war as a major with the Camouflage Training and Development Center.
So he was already a well-known magician.
Yes. He's a celebrity to the degree that... in an age before television and movies, really, a vaudeville magician can be a celebrity.
Sure.
He tells the story in his book of how he made his name in this camouflage group because they were just doing the old things. You know, they had a set of World War I tactics. They were going to put up netting with rags on it, and that's how you prevented an aerial attack. And instead... Maskelyne's a stage magician. He thinks, you know, the magician is always looking for the new tactic, the trick you can't figure out how it was done.
Right.
And he tells the story of an army inspector general named Lord Gort, who is apparently not a robot or a space alien, but that's just an upper-class name, I guess, in the UK.
They do have much better names than we do.
You can just be a twit named Gort.
Lloyd Gort. No less.
Lord Gort.
Oh, Lord Lloyd
yes,
Gort?
Yes, he's been knighted.
Uh-huh.
He was just Mr. Gort until the king decided he should be Lord Gort.
Well, it might have been his grandfather who was knighted.
It's true. Right? Maybe he didn't do anything. He's a Nepo Gort.
Well, he's going to do something because he's in your story. He's making it into the omnibus.
He's making an inspection of the camouflage training group, and Maskelyne's group is assigned to hide a machine gun nest. And they do it with such aplomb that Lord Gort can't figure it out. You know, they put up red herring things that he finds, but of course, the red herrings have enabled them to hide a machine gun nest right under his feet. And he says, well, clearly there is no nest here, gentlemen, at which point Maskelyne's men pop up from a grassy depression right in front of him and say, but we're right here, your lordship. And yet this cunning arrangement of mirrors... have hidden us from all but the most penetrating Hunnish eye.
This is something that they do at sniper school. There's a whole sniper school competition where it's like, we're going to sit up here and actually watch this field, and the person that gets the closest to us without going over wins the showcase.
So Gort is, his monocle falls out. He can't believe he has fallen for all their traps.
He is the sixth Viscount Gort.
Wow.
So the Gort, the Wisconsin of Gort.
You have to wonder, just like Maskelyne, where are these names coming from? Where are these science fiction names coming from in Victorian England?
I don't know, but
where did they import the Gort?
He really looks like the Viscount Gort. He's got the mustache and he's very severe.
They invite Lord Gort down to the nest they've dug to show him how the trick works. But like a good magician, they have an extra trick on a trick that they're not going to reveal to him. He gets down and they're like, and now look through this. And they have him look through a little, whatever what do you call the peephole in a bunker like that?
Let's call it a peephole.
They have him look through the peephole. And, you know, this has nothing to do with the pay toilets that you were leering about earlier, John. Mm-hmm. He looks through it and he sees the River Thames with a Nazi battleship advancing down it. Which surprises him somewhat, not just because there's a Nazi, not a naval presence on the Thames, but also because the Thames does not run anywhere near Farnham, England. So they've been able, and he says, boo, 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 and he looks again and it's all gone. And they say, your lordship, this is the kind of illusion that only we in the Royal Engineers Camouflage Training and Development Center can perfect if you will just give us, the resources of His Majesty's army.
Imagine how they could fool the Germans. If
you can fool one inbred Viscount. So this is the origin story, that they're able to show him a fake German battleship just with, a miniature ship somewhere that they've managed to to project in front of his field of view. And he is given a ragtag group that comes to be known during the war in his memoirs as the Magic Gang. It kind of seems like the kind of people who would not have been at home in most other divisions of the Royal Engineers, let alone the Army. You know, he's got poets and amazing trompe-l'oeil mural painters and surrealists and zoologists and
hypnotizers.
Stained glass, exactly. The men who stare at goats, basically. Stained glass craftsmen and circus performers and, these people can fight a war that no one else has even imagined. They call themselves the Magic Gang, and with the success of their tricks that they've demonstrated, they are sent off to North Africa to baffle Rommel and, as it turns out, alter the outcome of the war. And this is where Maskelyne's book has a series of amazing anecdotes of daring do. You know, he does all kinds of exploits in the desert that you would not believe, in which... one of my favorites is concerns the British evacuation of Tobruk. Unfortunately, this is going to have to go through...
This is in Libya.
Yeah, it's going to have to go through an area controlled by the mystics known as the Dervishes, the Whirling Dervishes. And they have an imam who does not want to let the British through. And negotiations fail, and so Maskelyne is sent to talk to the imam.
And he shows him a German battleship.
He decides to show off British influence and power by showing off magic tricks that the imam cannot do. So it turns into basically a version of the story in Exodus chapter 7 about Pharaoh's magicians.
This feels a little bit like a Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's court.
That's basically it. In an ornate palace in Damascus, the meeting quickly turns into a magic duel where Maskelyne makes an... the imam goes first. The imam makes an orange tree appear and blossom out of nothing.
The imam is also a magician?
Well, the imam, yeah, of course. He's a holy man, and unless you think he's just doing authentic miracles, he's got a few tricks up his
capacious
sleeves, right?
Sure.
Maskelyne says, well, I've seen that orange trick in London, so I'll do something you haven't seen. And he makes his fingers light on fire the imam has seen that one, so he produces an egg from which he reveals a dove, which flies away. Maskelyne then produces a butterfly from his handkerchief. The imam makes a vase levitate, so Maskelyne produces various items from his mouth that could not possibly have fit there.
This is amazing. I wish I'd been at this.
Who knew that this is how Rommel was defeated, John?
What a detente.
The imam produces a flying carpet. Maskelyne then escalates to shooting himself in the hand with a pistol and producing the bullet. Razor blades come from his mouth. It all ends with the imam impaling himself on a spear, which comes out his back. And now Maskelyne has him because he leans over and says, I know exactly how that spear bends. I know where the little leather passage in your cloak is that allows it to pass through. You see, I've done that trick before. And you probably don't want me to tell your followers how you did that trick. So why don't you let the British evacuation go through your territory?
He doesn't beat him. He beats him at his own game.
Correct. Because he knows, you can't outfox a fox.
Yeah,
you know?
he stands to lose more by being unmasked than by letting the British pass. If I seem distracted, I'm sorry. It's that while intently listening to you, also found a website where they sell hand-painted Lord Gorts.
Wait, why are people selling hand-painted Lord Gorts? Is he an icon of the British war effort that I've never heard of?
Because I have found the website where they have hand-painted figurines for people that don't have the time to make their own Ronin. There are Ronins here and Crimeans and...
from
the life of Jesus.
How many hundreds of dollars in Gortamobilia did you spend while I was telling the story of the magician's duel?
What's incredible about these hand-painted lead figurines is they're extremely expensive. Lord Gort is $150.
Well, they know how much money these people have. You know, this is not a This is not a working class hobby to collect pewter Lord Gorts.
I'm just trying to picture, like, okay, I've got a big piece of plywood in my spare room. I'm building a diorama of a crucial battle, and what I need is a Lord Gort, and I'm willing to pay for it.
I think what we've seen is there's a marketplace here for discount Lord Gort.
I see.
Equipment. You know, you could be underselling this guy.
Sure,
if you make a tidy profit.
If you make it in overseas, you could sell it for $75 and clean up.
So not all the stories in his book are as baroque as this wizard's duel, but they're all very colorful. You know, he's kind of an early Q division guy, you know, single-handedly putting all kinds of escape gear, saw blades and lockpicks and whatnot in just the brim of your army uniform caps, or, you know, hidden in secret compartments in everybody's boots, a jacket button that doubles as a compass, lining that actually turns into a very detailed silk map of North Africa. And, you know, he reports that, you know, he's honored that he later learns after the war that a whole boxcar full of people headed to a Nazi POW or concentration camp somewhere was able to escape because somebody had the saw blade that he had cleverly hidden with his magician's know-how in some general issue bit of kit, as you would say, yeah, in Dad's army. Some of the stories are, you know, actually have to do with the kind of camouflage you would expect him to be doing. You know, a bunch of green tanks come into the desert, and he says, well, these were clearly made for the Somme, not for Egypt. How do we get these the color of the sand? And so he and his men scavenge in a dump, and they find all kinds of, what do you call it when stuff is extra? Surplus, plaster of Paris, and a bunch of rancid Worcestershire sauce. And they mix all this stuff together. The Worcestershire sauce is specifically mentioned. I'm not sure why.
Interesting.
And they make an amazing base for paint, but it's not quite the right color. And they can't find anything that quite duplicates the sands of the Sahara until Maskelyne sees it's been right under his nose all along. Camel dung.
No.
If they could just get the right proportion of camel poop in with their plaster and Worcestershire sauce, all these tanks would be invisible to Hitler's bombers.
So how did he collect enough poop?
He recruits a whole army of, you know, the magic gang quickly sets its eyes to...
They go to the Bedouin and say...
Yeah, a bunch of Cairo street pickpockets are now charged with bringing all the camel dung they can to keep their tanks painted, and it's smelly, but it works. You mentioned the inflatable tanks. Maskelyne says he invents what he called sun shields, basically a bunch of collapsible canvas frames that do the opposite. They make tanks look like trucks.
Oh.
So, you know, from Hitler's air surveillance, it looks as if a bunch of trucks are providing material somewhere. In fact, it's collapsible canvas frames that are just making tanks look boxy. And the tanks, but how do you hide the tread marks, John?
How do you?
You apparently drag some chainmail behind your tank that that obscures the tread marks as they are being made and makes them look more like truck tread.
Yeah, I bet you Lord Gort had so much chainmail, banging around his.
He's got generations of chainmail up in Castle Gort.
Yeah, and he's going to all his friends. And
they've all got sex dungeons, yeah, for sure.
Bring your chain mail.
And, you know, the sun shields turn out to be decisive in the North African campaign.
How do they work? Do they just reflect the sun into the eyes of Luftwaffe pilots?
No, trucks as tanks as trucks are called sun shields.
Oh, I see.
And then, of course, you can do it the other way around. He often does the trick both ways. Like, he's got stories of much more ambitious camouflage, like Admiral Cunningham has requested a decoy battleship so that Hitler thinks they have more, you know, troops at the mouth of the Nile or whatever than they do. He finds an old cruiser, you know, an abandoned cruiser that's basically scrap metal, and camos it up to look like a battleship, but finds that it's not convincing. So he then takes his fake battleship and puts bad counter camouflage on it to make it look like it's a beat-up cruiser, you know? Fake smokestacks that are clearly wrong, badly painted damage on it. So it looks like what he's got is a battleship pretending to be cruiser, when really it's a It's an old Hulk pretending to be a battleship, pretending to be an old Hulk.
Wow. Talk about a switcheroo.
This is the kind of thing that Hitler cannot possibly, you know,
keep up with. What a mind game.
Hitler's combing the desert for biblical artifacts, but he's missing the real magic happening right in front of his very eyes. And then once he's done that a few times, then they can take real ships and do the same lousy camouflage on it. Or they can make trucks look like the tanks as trucks.
Right.
And Hitler doesn't know what he's dealing with.
What do you do? What do you got there? A truck? A tank? A tank truck? Truck tank?
You were asking if you could razzle-dazzle the Nazis with real sun shields. That's what he did to defend the Suez Canal. He put up rotating tin reflectors around these lights at night, which would literally blind and dazzle would-be bombers with a lighting effect that made it impossible to bomb or strafe. So the Suez Canal was defended. He writes about creating a submarine fleet out of old sleeper cars. Like he would dump railroad cars. He would float railroad cars in the Mediterranean and simulate subs.
I mean, this all feels pretty cheap too. Like bang for the buck.
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, His Majesty's government is loving this because he's doing all this with surplus Worcestershire sauce. The Magic Gang is resourceful. They are, and they're creating effects, like he writes about distracting from Montgomery's actual troop movement at El Alamein by staging a fake attack on the coast, a fake naval attack at Fuca, which they do just with a series of stage tricks, basically. Oil pots making enough smoke that you can't tell there's not a bunch of boats there, gramophones playing engine sounds of bigger boats and planes, fireworks instead, you know, catapults shooting projectiles instead of
cannon.
Actual artillery, to the degree that, you know, that's why El Alamein succeeds, because the Nazis or Rommel had to throw too many resources at the coast where this non-invasion is happening. His greatest feat, you know, you mentioned kind of the David Copperfield making the Eiffel Tower disappear. He made Alexandria Harbor disappear.
Mm-hmm.
He was tasked by the Admiralty with making the entire city of Alexandria bomber-proof. And he doesn't know how to do it, but he sees up the coast, there's a slightly smaller inlet at Mariette Bay that kind of resembles the inlet of the Alexandria Harbor. He builds a miniature Alexandria there with its own, you know, scale streets, smaller lighthouses that can still rotate. Then he puts up real gun emplacements to defend it, and he makes sure that when the Luftwaffe come, these lights stay on a little too long, so they get a glimpse, and then the lights go out. And then when the bombers come in and bomb his bay, which is not Alexandria Harbor, the Magic Gang goes in during the day and puts in fake wreckage. So the next time they do daytime surveillance, they can see that, you know, that it looks worse there. For 8 nights of bombing, his fake Alexandria was bombed, protecting the real harbor.
Think about the desert wombats that were living out there, just their whole lives, just feeling like, what an easy life. And then all of a sudden, 8 days of bombing.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of extinct flora and fauna.
I mean, if you
used to live in Mariette Bay.
If you live in London, you're like, yeah, we had that coming, but yeah, they're just a bunch of flowers.
Now, these stories are so remarkable that, you know, the book, the hardcover volume, Magic Top Secret, with its weird kind of pink and navy dust jacket, didn't sell particularly well. But in 1983, a writer named David French must have discovered it and published a book called The War Magician, where he, you know, as improbable and crazy as those stories were, he amps them up into... You know, he amps up the relationships and the personalities and makes it even more novelistic. And The War Magician actually does become a hit book.
This isn't David French, the New York Times editorialist.
No. In fact, now that you say that, I'm a little worried that I have the date, that I have the author wrong, because you're right. There is David French, the awful op-ed guy. No, David Fisher, I think. Oh, there okay. we go. Okay. David Fisher.
Good.
Thank you. So David Fisher puts out The War Magician, and this actually does catch everyone's eye. It gets optioned by Hollywood. Peter Weir was going to direct it at one point. Tom Cruise is, you know, usually mentioned for over a decade as the name of the actor who will be portraying Jasper Maskelyne in this.
Does seem like a pretty good movie.
I mean, this would make an amazing movie. In fact, there is a British TV movie made at one point of Maskelyne's exploits. Because, you know, if we go by the account in Magic Top Secret, later transmitted to the next generation via Fisher's The War Magician, this changed the course of the war in Africa. Like, Rommel and Hitler were constantly being outfoxed by this wily stage magician and his ragtag group of outsiders. It's made for Hollywood. But our story then jumps 10 years, not just in time, but across the world. Let's go to the Blue Mountains of Queensland, shall we?
Oh, Blue Mountains of Queensland. I've been waiting for the show to take us there.
I bet you weren't expecting this sudden shift to Australia. Maybe some of the listeners still have whiplash.
No one expects the Blue Mountains of Queensland.
But stay with me. A researcher and amateur magician, a magic historian named Richard Stokes.
A magic historian.
I mean, he's not using magic to do history. He's not a magical historian.
Oh, I see.
He's a historian of stage magic.
Well, that was Ricky Jay. We don't need a second one.
Australia has its own bargain basement Ricky Jay.
Of course, they have their own culture, weirdly.
You know how Canadians always have their own little cute, you know, they've got their own little Time magazine called Maclean's, and they've got their own little Harvard called McGill. It's delightful.
Yeah, they put a Mick in front of of something and call it the equivalent.
They've got their own Bob Dylan called Gordon Lightfoot.
Yeah.
But they've also got their own Neil Young called Neil Young.
They have a Neil Young.
They did very well. So Australia has its own Ricky Jay. Richard Stokes at an old auction buys a ton of old magic magazines, and he becomes fascinated by this story of Jasper Maskelyne and winning the war, dueling with Hitler in the arena of stage magic on a vast scale. You know, before David Copperfield was making the Statue of Liberty disappear, this is the guy that was doing that with lives on the line. And so Stokes becomes very interested in Maskelyne and these books that have been written about him. And he happens to be shortly thereafter at a birthday party where none other than Angela Maskelyne is in attendance. And it turns out she is, yeah, exactly. She's one of the millions of other Maskelynes that live in the Brisbane suburbs.
Uh-huh.
No, she is in fact the granddaughter of Jasper Maskelyne, who retired to Kenya and passed away in the late 60s, early 70s or so.
That's a thing that never happens anymore.
Moving to Kenya and then dying?
Well, no, I mean...
I think it's quicker now.
retiring after the war to your Kenyan estate.
I think the Kenyans are delighted that they are no longer the site for white people to find an estate.
From a guy with a riding crop, although his riding crop was maybe a magic wand.
Ooh, you never know. It's the kind of thing where it turns into a bouquet when he whips you. Stokes wants to know more about these stories. And I think we can say at this point that he is a little bit skeptical. Like, he wants the actual history and not the mythologizing of the magic gang that this guy was doing in his own memoirs after the war.
Typical historian.
You know, because all this stuff was classified. You know, he's not going to be able to find out. He's not going to get the history here. He wants to go to the horse's mouth. And Angela says that, my dad, Jasper Maskelyne's son Alistair, now lives in Queensland. He was a commercial pilot for many years. And he knows all this stuff firsthand. He heard all these stories. You should talk to him. So Stokes is able to begin a personal correspondence and even get to know Jasper's own son, Alistair Maskelyne, who paints a very different story of the magic gang. He explains that in 1935, before the war, I mean, not before Hitler, but before the war.
Sure.
Maskelyne was actually in quite a career downturn. Even though he was one of the most prominent magical names on the British scene, he was struggling to make a living with, you know, as many music hall dates a year as he could get.
It was the Great Depression everywhere.
It was a tough time. He had rented a little cottage in Surrey for his young family, and he was having a hard time making ends meet. He did not know how to buy groceries for his kids. And so when a ghostwriter came to him and said, hey, I have an idea for a kind of a fictionalized version of your life and career, you know, let's put out a book. He is eager to collaborate and not too meticulous about, not too scrupulous about the facts.
Mm-hmm.
So with this ghostwriter, he writes a book called White Magic, which is just full of, Alistair Maskelyne later tells Richard Stokes, full of wholly invented sequences, because it turns out the life of a British working magician is not actually full of as much intrigue as you would hope. It's a... You know, maybe you can speak to this from the backstage view of the rock and roll musician. Not as glamorous as people think.
No, super boring most of the time.
So if you're writing, imagine how much more boring it is for a 1930s medium-level stage magician.
I mean, I can tell you, knowing a few magicians now and comedians, dull. All of show business is dull.
It would be a shabby, shabby life. So instead, he and his ghostwriter, I think a man named Frank Stewart, if I'm getting this right, invent a lot of things, and Alistair tells Stokes, quote, my father seemed not to mind these fictitious events. And so...
that totally glamorized him.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he didn't mind. And so after the war, when Maskelyne retires from the Royal Engineers as a major, Stewart comes to him again and thinks he should do a work about his wartime exploits. And that's the story behind Magic, Top Secret.
Yeah, all of this sounded really fun and cool like a movie, but also it feels like if magic had played a massive role in Al-Alamein, I would have heard about it.
Wouldn't this be the first thing you learn about World War II if people actually could move the city of Alexandria with some smoke and mirrors?
It does seem like a thing that would have made it into some of those, like, World War II books I read in sixth grade.
Yeah, amazing, amazing Nazi facts for kids.
Yeah,
like why? Yeah, why? If he really was doing a battle with an imam in a ornate Damascene palace, we would have known about this, right?
I feel like, I mean, considering that the History Channel is already 1/3 programs about Nazi weapons that you'd never heard of. Like the Nazis had made up some kind of cyclotron. It does feel like if there was a magic battle, that. So you're saying
if there was
that,
really a Dial of Destiny. So when this book gets written with all these stories, Alistair takes a look at it and he tells his dad, there is so much overdramatized fiction here that it is obviously untrue. And he asks his dad, why can't we do a real memoir? I mean, you really were in North Africa. You really were asked to do a lot of inventive tank camouflage, and surely you did some. Like, why don't you just put an actual memoir about what it was like in the trenches during the war with your buddies? And when Jasper relays this to Frank Stewart, the ghostwriter, Stewart says, well, there were thousands of such, you know, it would never sell. Basically, the British literary market is now glutted with people telling the story of their war.
Yeah, sure.
As you can imagine.
I too was in the war. I too was in Alexandria.
And so when Stokes asks Alistair, so what about all the stories? Alistair says, well, the entire thing is a load of rubbish. That's his characterization of Magic Top Secret. And Stokes says, well, what about this? What about the 1983 David Fisher book? Like, where did this even come from? And he says, I have a theory that this guy must have just been basing it on the ghostwritten book, Magic Top Secret, in combination with maybe he had access to your dad's journals or something. Like, where did the illustrations come from? And Alistair confirms, that's exactly right. When my dad died in Kenya, his diaries, which are basically just scrapbooks of clippings about the war and about his career and about, you know, his own embroidered stories, those all turned up at his brother Noel's home. And somehow Fisher got access to them. And between, without doing any original research, between the ghostwritten 49 book and these scrapbooks, he was able to really spin a yarn that got Hollywood interested. And when Stokes asks him about the Fisher book, he says it's only 40% reliable at best. Basically, all the relationships are made up, all the character stuff is made up, and many of the sequences are fictional. Stokes says, is it nonfiction? He says, no, it's definitely, is it nonfiction? He says, definitely it's creative nonfiction.
Okay.
So
that's how I'm hoping to build my own career.
Yeah, I think I feel like a lot of omnibus is creative nonfiction, right? So Stokes, this now being 2003 or so, writes this up and starts getting these revisionist stories about the real Jasper Maskelyne into, you know, magicians' journals and historical journals, but basically niche magic publications.
Right.
Because that's his world.
And also, who else would give a care?
Kind of, yeah.
Remember the person you've never heard of? Well, I'm unmasking it.
That's kind of true, because none of this ever really bubbled up enough into the popular, but enough that, you know, you would find a bunch of popular history would use it as this amazing World War II sidelight you'd never heard of.
Right.
And he's going to be the bummer who bums everybody out by saying what really happened. And Stokes starts, because this is 2003, he starts a blog.
Sure.
He starts maskelynemagic.com, which is devoted to his original research on, you know, the real story of the Magic Gang. And his take is that basically there was no Magic
Gang. No Magic Gang at all.
No, never existed.
It does feel like he would have been promoted to lieutenant colonel lieutenant colonel.
If you make a fake harbor that distracts the Luftwaffe for a full week.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you should be getting the Victoria Cross for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, maybe not a field marshalship, but certainly, you know, a hat with braid on it.
Whereas if you're sitting in the desert saying, hey, this kind of netting actually would look better if we put some burlap on it.
Yeah, that's major label business.
And that's probably what he was doing. Because Stokes says that, you know, there really was camouflage work being done by Major Maskelyne in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the Allies did, as you said, the Allies did use this kind of military deception. But a lot of the stories he appropriated were just not his. For example, you can look at his service record and realize he joined up after El Alamein. So a lot of the chronologies of his heroic foxing of Rommel are just chronologically impossible. The good stories are all made up. Most of them are military tactics that were in use elsewhere, but were credited, you know, that others had actually come up with, which he then in his ghostwritten work credited to himself, which is really ballsy considering that, you know, the people who actually the people who actually did this stuff were still alive.
Well, here in Seattle, our own Boeing Plant 2, where the B-17s were made, very famously was camouflaged to look like a neighborhood.
And it wasn't bombed once.
That's right.
Renton was largely left untouched by Hitler and Tojo.
Hitler never made it over to the Duwamish River Valley, and and mostly because of this camouflage. But that was that's the real story of Alexandria, is South Park in the Duwamish,
and stuff like this was going on. You know, there were inventive camouflage. You know, misdirection, as you say, you know, balloons that looked like tanks and tanks that looked like trucks, and all this was going on. In fact, these sun shields, these collapsible canvas frames around tanks, Stokes have decided, appear to be a Jasper Maskelyne original.
Okay.
That were used in the war and may have had some intelligence success. The camel poop thing appears to be real.
Okay.
The Magic Gang, such as it, you know, a group of people did find out that you could mix camel dung into plaster of Paris and you would get a nice, cheap, sand-colored camouflage for green tanks.
Cool.
Again, I don't think you're going to get Tom Cruise in the lead in the movie about the guy who realizes you can put camel shit on tanks.
Wait. And Worcestershire sauce.
Don't forget the Worcestershire sauce. Very important. The idea to put silk maps of the territory in the lining of uniforms appears to be his. And there is an account of somebody using one of his jacket buttons that conceals a compass, to get back to behind the enemy lines.
Right.
So it's not like Maskelyne was doing nothing, but he basically wrote a 200-page book of derring do, outrageous Orientalist escapades in the Middle East that never happened. And for, I don't know, 15 years, maskelynemagic.com was your one-stop shop for really the only person on earth who cared enough about, because people would continue to write books and do TV depictions of this stuff, even though real heads knew it never actually happened.
I mean, I feel like you could write a The Kingsman style, like, comedy adventure movie where somebody befuddles a sultan by making a camel disappear. That all seems, I mean, these days, I don't feel like anybody cares whether a thing is true or not.
I just saw the movie about the guy who invented Tetris, and it's amazing how many car chases and assassination attempts there were just in an attempt to get the handheld rights to Tetris out of Gorbachev-era Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, in our day and age, what is truth even?
And they can still say at the beginning of the movie, inspired by true events, because that's what all the dads want to see.
Ripped from the headlines.
In front of their movie. And you can immediately tell the point in the movie where you're like, well, I bet he did have a translator, but I bet she wasn't KGB. And furthermore, I bet she didn't switch sides later. And that's I bet there was not a high-speed car chase through the streets of London to the Moscow airport.
Chances are she wasn't a 27-year-old half-Japanese martial artist.
But sadly, you know, the whole raison d'etre of Omnibus is that important historical stories are forever being lost.
And I'm trying to figure out whether this story is about masculine, about the unmasking of masculine, about the remasking of unmasking of masculine.
He's unmasked? He's just a Lin?
Well, yeah, it seemed like one of your characters was prepared to unmask him. Demask him.
Yeah, I think Stokes is pretty successful in saying everything about the Magic Gang that you might want to make into a Tom Cruise movie was just made up by an in-house ghostwriter for Maskelyne's publisher in the years after the war when he couldn't play enough club gigs to support his kids.
I mean, when you look at the history of Ian Fleming and the degree to which his time in MI6 or whatever during the war has been turned into like this amazing spy career.
What a spy master he probably was.
Some 22-year-old sitting behind a desk in a long room.
Probably in Jamaica somewhere.
Barely.
Not exactly the front lines.
He has yet to really have his series of articles about how he was a pencil pusher.
But this is a really interesting case because Richard Stokes' Australian debunking is pretty definitive, and it should be what you find when you try to look this guy up and see what the deal is. And it's not. Instead, you find dozens of listicle sites telling you, according to Maskelyne, he made the Suez Canal into a disco light show, and he made Alexandria disappear, and who knows? Who can say if these things are true?
Are these some of those articles where you have to scroll down and there's an ad every three paragraphs?
That is correct, yeah. And then nowadays you don't know which of them was actually written by a chatbot. Yeah. And that's largely because in 2022, Stokes' site, maskelynemagic.com, disappeared from the internet.
Did Maskelyne make it disappear?
That's correct.
Or was it Hitler?
The Luftwaffe was coming, and the website had to go underground. No, I think just like a lot of that blog-era content that really we were so worried for all this time about archived library content getting replaced in the age of the transitory internet that we didn't consider that all these internet-era archives were going to disappear as well.
Aren't they out there somewhere? Aren't those blogs somewhere out there?
I mean, thanks to the Wayback Machine, I spent this week happily reading Richard Stokes's pages and pages of takedowns of, here's why the Alexandria Harbor thing would not have worked. Look at a map. Now look at a timeline. Now look at tank movements. Now, you know.
So the time machine does preserve all the lost blogs. So they're not lost.
Well, they're not search engineable anymore.
Oh.
Like, you really have to go to, I mean, it's not
just like microfiche.
It's not the dark web, but it's the equivalent of looking at a microfiche reader. You have to, you know, which is nice. You know, now people like me can happily spend all day in a darkened room.
Oh my God.
Sorting through dead newspaper clippings, trying to find the one.
People like you who already were going to spend all day in a dark room searching through old newspaper clippings.
But now it can be about Nazis and stage magicians. So, you know, in the ultimate bit of close-up magic, this whole debunking, Maskelyne has made this whole debunking disappear.
Yes.
From beyond the grave. And if you
voila!
As the British said. And if you go to maskelynemagic.com today, you see a Korean casino squatting there.
Qua?
Voila. Hey, presto. It's now Korean internet gambling.
Why would anyone go? Why would anyone find it? Why would they want to be squatting there?
I assume somebody is
just for you.
Somebody is mass buying a series of sites that did once have traffic at a certain level and are now up for sale. And some bot somewhere buys them. And now, if you try to research the World War II exploits of the Magic Gang, you instead are encouraged to do like offshore Korean casino gambling.
Up to that moment when you went there, you were probably the first person to go there in 10 years and the last person that's going to start gambling at a Korean online casino.
They're so disappointed.
They're like, oh.
They thought the demographics would align perfectly and it turned out to just be me and... you know, and I don't like the $20 table.
Yeah, no, you're not sitting there asking for $100,000 more in those square chips.
You can be two kinds of old people, and I'm turning into the one that wants Hitler stories.
Yeah.
And not the one that wants to play the slots for 16 hours.
I feel like all those Jimmy Buffett-based communities in Florida, now that Jimmy Buffett has passed away, are looking for a kind of, you know, like... insouciant like rocker. And maybe it's me. I mean, I'd love to drive a golf cart every day.
I hate to tell you this, but all those communities switched from Jimmy Buffett to a different over-the-top truth teller about 6 years ago.
Oh, who's the other over-the-top truth tellers? John Mayer?
He was president from 2016 to 2020. They got a new guy.
Oof.
Some would say it's their own damn fault.
And that concludes The Magic Gang, entry 747.EX0722, certificate number 37883 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, there's zero chance that social media is still going to exist in their era. I'm going to rewrite that.
I can't even find this blog about Australian magic history.
We're going to have to come up with a new outro. We've been doing this outro for how long have we been doing this show? 5 years?
Over 5 years.
Over 5 years, and we've been saying the same thing. And
I think it turns six this winter.
We don't even believe our own outros now.
But will people complain if it changes?
A certain percentage of the people will complain.
Who comes to a podcast for soothing ritual? Everybody.
Yeah.
Like.
And this is the thing. They're all asleep now, and we're going to wake them up if we change the outro.
The first time you said many goods and cheese, you woke up 6,000 people.
What? Oh, John.
I was just nodding off.
Anyway, you can find us wherever if you Google the words futurelings, you're probably going to find some defunct blogs. Who are trying to like do sci-fi fanfic, and then most of your search returns will be something to do with this show. Futurelings out there everywhere, being woken up by minor changes we make. But you can find Ken still on Blue Sky at Ken Jennings, and I'm over on Instagram writing really long things that nobody reads. You can also find at Omnibus Project. I don't know what you find at Omnibus Project. Is there still that one that was Omnibus Random Quotes?
Omnibus Out of Context is still on the former Twitter, ex-Twitter. I love Omnibus Out of Context.
I do too.
We recently were complaining about how incoherent we would sound if anybody were to actually provide a transcript of the show.
Yeah.
And Omnibus Out of Context posted a transcript of us saying that, and we were correct. It is completely incoherent.
Yeah, there it is. I mean, we're pretty incoherent in context. So imagine if we were out of context.
It's just not fair.
You can email us and explain to us things, whatever your area of expertise is. If you are currently in Egypt, email us. Just so we know you're there.
Tell us Alexandria and the Suez Canal are still there, because it's not clear.
No, that's right.
There might be scale models of them dotting the desert.
That's right. I was bedazzled by all your tin searchlights. email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send us actual mail, real live mail, a thing that still exists in our era, but probably not in yours, to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. And we encourage you to support the production of this show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. And if you are already members of our Patreon, consider changing your donation level to something on the scale of 5 times greater than what you currently give.
Give till it hurts.
But if you think about 5 times as being the standard, and then you're like, I'm going to get a deal by only increasing my donation by 3 times.
Or I'm going to outshine the baseline by giving 7 times.
Yeah, that's right.
Switch to the cheaper brand of soup. Switch to store brand soup and give the difference to patreon.com/omnibusproject. It's almost as good.
Yeah. With that, I'm sorry to have to have woken you up. You can go back to sleep here while Ken does the outro.
You have to do your famous sign out, and I guess that's about it, or whatever.
I want to write that in there, too.
Yeah, it's classic. It's like Ed Sullivan or something. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back to you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.